Well, I'd like to welcome you all to this event, a reading by Derek Walcott. The way we'll play it is that I will do a very short introduction, and then Derek will read, and then we'll engage in a few questions, and then take questions from the floor. We have our two roving microphones, so people could... we've organized it efficiently so that people could ask questions. Derek Walcott was born in St. Lucia and is the author of a dozen books of poetry, the latest being Tiapolo's Hound, which is an intense meditation on the life and work of Pissarro, the French Caribbean painter. He was awarded the Queen's Medal for Poetry in 1988 and the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1992. In 1959, he set up the Trinidad Theatre Workshop to explore political, social, and cultural issues of the region. Quote, "I seek a theatre," he said, "that conveys the power of Jacobean theatre, that has the vigour of common speech, and that has the appeal of the Elizabethan pit, vulgar, rhetorical, but memorable." The 20 plays or so that Walcott has written are vivid and voluble and riotous, and they bear the stench and the eloquence of the Elizabethan pit. In 1961, he received the Obie Award, which is an off-Broadway theatre award for his drama. It has been 55 years since Walcott has been writing poetry, perhaps 56 years in terms of publication, poetry that is sensuous, lyrical, and astonishingly beautiful. His first book, 25 Poems, was published in 1948. In his poem, The Schooner Flight, he writes, quote, "I am just a red nigger who love the sea. I have a sound colonial education. I have Dutch, nigger, and English in me, and either I'm nobody or I'm a nation." Ladies and gentlemen, I give you tonight the nation and the imagination of St. Lucia and the Caribbean region. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to read from about two books. One of them is from the collected poems. The first poem is Names for Edward Braithwaite. My race began as the sea began, with no nouns and with no horizon, with pebbles under my tongue, with a different fix on the stars. But now my race is here in the sad oil of Levantine eyes, in the flags of the Indian fields. I began with no memory. I began with no future. But I looked for that moment when the mind was halved by a horizon. I have never found that moment when the mind was halved by a horizon. For the goldsmith from Benares, the stone cutter from Canton, as a fish line sinks, the horizon sinks in the memory. Have we melted into a mirror, leaving our souls behind? The goldsmith from Benares, the stone cutter from Canton, the bronze smith from Benin. A sea eagle screams from the rock, and my race began like the osprey, with that cry, that terrible vowel, that I. Behind us all, the sky folded as history folds over a fish line, and the foam foreclosed, with nothing in our hands but this stick to trace our names on the sand, which the sea erased again to our indifference. And when they named these bays, bays, was it nostalgia or irony? In the uncombed forest, in uncultivated grass, where was their elegance except in their mockery? Where were the courts of Castile, Versailles colonnades supplanted by cabbage palms with Corinthian crests, belittling diminutives? Then little Versailles meant plans for a pigsty, names for the sour apples and green grapes of their exile. Their memory turned acid, but the names held. Valencia glows with the lanterns of oranges. Mayaro's charred candelabra of cocoa. Being men, they could not live except they first presumed the right of everything to be a noun. The African acquiesced, repeated, and changed them. Listen, my children, say Maubin the hog plum, Cerise the wild cherry, Baila the bay, with the fresh green voices that they were once themselves in the way the wind bends our natural inflections. These palms are greater than Versailles, for no man made them. Their fallen columns greater than Castile, no man unmade them, except the worm, who has no helmet, but was always the emperor. And children, look at these stars over Valencia's forest. Not Orion, not Betelgeuse. Tell me, what do they look like? Answer, you damn little Arabs. Sir, fireflies caught in molasses. St. Lucie, the villages. Laborie, Choiseul, Vieuxfort, Dennery. From these sun-bleached villages where the church bell caves in the sides of one gray-scurfed shack that is shuttered with warped boards, with rust, with crabs crawling under the house shadow where the children played house, a net rotting among cans, the sea net of sunlight trawling the shallows, catching nothing all afternoon. From these I am growing no nearer to what secret eluded the children under the house shade in the far bell, the noon-stunned amethystine sea, something always being missed between the floating shadow and the pelican in the smoke from over the next bay, in that shack on the lip of the sand spit, whatever the seagulls cried out for through the gray drifting ladders of rain and the great gray tree of the waterspout for which the dolphins kept diving that should have rounded the day. Pomarac, Otaheite apple, Pomsiter, Pongonet, Maubin, Zanana, the pineapple's Aztec helmet, pom, I have forgotten what pom for the Irish potato, Cerise, the cherry, Zaman, sea almonds, by the crisp sea bursts, au bord de la rivière. Come back to me, my language. Come back, caco, gris-gris, solitaire, ciseau, the scissor bird, no nightingales except once in the indigo mountains of Jamaica, blue depth, deep as coffee, flicker of pimento, the shaft light on a yellow aki, the bark a lone bear, jardin à montagne, en habitation, the wet leather reek of the hill donkey. Evening opens at a text of fireflies. In the mountain huts, tikai habitation, candles, candle flies, the black night bending cups in its hard palms, cool, thin water. This is important water. Important, imported. Water is important. Also very important, the red rust drum, the evening deep as coffee, the morning powerful, important coffee. The villages shut all day in the sun. In the empty schoolyard, teacher dead today. The fruit rotting yellow on the ground dies from Gauguin. The palm arac dyes the earth purple. The ochre road still waiting in the sun for my shadow. Also, you is Walcott, you is Roddy Brother, teacher Alexan, and the small rivers with important names. And the important corporal in the country station habitation, looking towards the thick green slopes of cocoa, the sun that melts the asphalt at noon, and the woman in the shade of the breadfruit bent over the lip of the valley. Below her, blue, green, the last valleys of sugar, the bus rides, the fields of bananas. The tanker still rusts in the lagoon at Roseau. and around what corner was uttered a single yellow leaf from the frangipani, a tough bark, reticent, but when it flowers, delivers hard lilies, pungent, recalling Martina or Eunice or Lucilla, who comes down the steps with a cool side flow as spring water eases over shells of rock in some green ferny hole by the road in the mountains, her smile like the whole country, her smell earth, red brown earth, her armpits a reaping, her arms saplings, an old woman that she is now with other generations of daughters flowing down the steps, Jean Bitation, Belle Tifi Bitation, until their teeth go and all the rest. Oh, Martinas, Lucillas, I'm a wild golden apple that will burst with love of you and your men. Those I never told enough with my young poet's eyes, crazy with the country. Generations going, generations gone. Moi, c'est Jean Saint-Lucy, c'est là ma sortie. It's there that I born. The Sadhu of Couva. For Kenneth Ramchand. When sunset, a brass gong vibrate through Couva. It's then I see my soul swiftly unsheathed, like a white cattle bird growing more small over the ocean of the evening canes. And I sit quiet, waiting for it to return like a hog cattle blistered with mud, because for my spirit, India is too far. And to that gong sometimes bald clouds in saffron robes assemble, sacred to the evening, sacred even to Ramlochan singing Indian hits from his jute hammock, while evening strokes the flanks and silver horns of his maroon taxi. As the mosquitoes whine their evening mantras, my friend Anopheles on the sitar, and the fireflies making every dusk Diwali. I knot my head with a cloud, my white mustache bristle like horns, my hands are brittle as the pages of Ramayana, once the sacred monkeys multiplied like branches in the ancient temples. I did not miss them, because these fields sang of Bengal. Behind Ramlochan repairs, there was Uttar Pradesh. But time roars in my ears like a river. Old age is a conflagration as fierce as the cane fires of crop time. I will pass through these people like a cloud. They will see a white bird beating the evening sea of the canes behind the Couva. And who will point it as my soul unsheathed? Neither the bridegroom in beads, nor the bride in her veils, their sacred language on the cinema hoardings. I talk too damn much on the Couva Village Council. I talk too softly. I was always drowned by the loudspeakers in front of the stores or the loudspeakers with the greatest pictures. I am best suited to stalk like a white cattle bird on legs like sticks with sticking to the path between the canes on a district road at dusk, playing the elder. There are no more elders. It's only old people. My friends spit on the government. I do not think it's just a government. Suppose all the gods too old. Suppose they're dead and they're burning them. Supposing when some cane cutter start chopping up snakes with a cutlass, he is severing the snake-armed god. And suppose some hunter has caught Hanuman and his mischief in a monkey cage. Suppose all the gods were killed by electric light. Sunset, a bonfire roars in my ears. Embers of blown swallows dart and cry like women distracted around its cremation. I ascend to my bed of sweet sandalwood. The next poem is an elegy. It wasn't an elegy when he was alive, for Joseph Brodsky, who was a very close friend, and from whom I learned the dedication required to be, not from whom I learned, but who was an example to me of someone who devoted his life entirely to poetry. We were in Oklahoma to judge a contest, or not to award a prize to writers by a convocation of writers. And we were in a cottage there talking, and I remember sitting opposite Joseph and thinking that this man was the heir of Russian poetry as much as Mandelstam was, or Pasternak, or Pushkin. And he spoke Russian to me, and I spoke Creole to him, and I realized that language is merely sound, and neither is superior to the other. Forest of Europe. The last leaves fell like notes from a piano and left their ovals echoing in the air. With gawky music stands, the winter forest looks like an empty orchestra, its lines ruled on these scattered manuscripts of snow. The inlaid copper laurel of an oak shines through the brown bricked glass above your head as bright as whiskey, while the wintry breath of lines from Mandelstam, which you recite, uncoils as visibly as cigarette smoke. The rustling of ruble notes by the lemon never. Under your exile's tongue, crisp under heel, the gutturals crackle like decaying leaves. The phrase from Mandelstam circles with light in a brown room in barren Oklahoma. There is a Gulag archipelago under this ice, where the salt minerals spring of the long trail of tears run as these plains as hard and open as a herdsman's face, sun-cracked and stubbled with unshaven snow. Growing in whispers from the writers' congress, the snow circles like Cossacks round the corpse of a tired Choctaw till it is a blizzard of treaties and white papers as we lose sight of the single human through the cause. So every spring these branches load their shelves like libraries with newly published leaves till waste recycles them, paper to snow. But at zero of suffering, one mind lasts like this oak, with a few brazen leaves. As the train passed the forest tortured icons, the floors clanging like freight yards, then the spires of frozen tears, the stations screeching steam, he drew them in a single winter's breath, whose freezing consonants turned into stones. He saw the poetry in forlorn stations under clouds vast as Asia, through districts that could gulp Oklahoma like a grape. Not these tree-shaded prairie halls, but space so desolate it mocked destinations. Who is that dark child on the parapets of Europe, watching the evening river mint its sovereigns, stamped with power, not with poets? The Thames and the Never rustling like banknotes, then black on gold the Hudson's silhouettes. From frozen Neva to the Hudson, pours under the airport domes, the echoing stations, the tributary of emigrants whom exile has made as classless as a common cold, citizens of a language that is now yours. And every February, every last autumn, you write far from the threshing harvesters, folding wheat like a girl plaiting her hair, far from Russia's canals, quivering with sunstroke, a man living with English in one room. The tourist archipelagos of my south are prisons too, corruptible. And though there is no harder prison than writing verse, what's poetry if it is worth its salt but a phrase men can pass from hand to mouth across the centuries, the bread that lasts when systems have decayed, when in his forest of barbed wire branches a prisoner circles chewing the one phrase whose music will last longer than the leaves, whose condensation is the marble sweat of angels' foreheads, which will never dry till Borealis shuts the peacock lights of its slow fan from L.A. to Archangel, and memory needs nothing to repeat. Frightened and starved with divine fever, Osset Mandelstam shook, and every metaphor shuddered him with ague, each vowel heavier than a boundary stone, to the rustling of ruble notes by the lemon, never. But now that fever is a fire whose glow warms our hands, Joseph, as we grunt like primates exchanging gutturals in this winter cave of a brown cottage, while in drifts outside, mastodons force their systems through the snow. The last poem I'm going to read is a longish poem. I don't mean that long. It's called The Fortunate Traveler. There's a poem, book by Thomas Nash called The Unfortunate Traveler. This traveler is fortunate because he can go to third world countries on a return ticket. And in a way, that's the basis of our compassion now, that we can go to places like Haiti or Africa, anywhere where there's serious human pain and decimation. And the leader, the character in this poem, is someone who works for maybe the United Nations and who travels to these countries and is really pierced by the desolation that he sees. He tries to make an arrangement with the opposition of one country to sell them some tractors or to arrange some such transaction. But the government changes and his life is threatened. The epigraph is from Revelation 6:6. The poem is for Susan Sontag. The epigraph. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, "A measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine." It was in winter, steeples, spires congealed like holy candles, rotting snow flaked from Europe's ceiling. A compact man, I crossed the canal in a gray overcoat, on one lapel a crimson buttonhole for the cold ecstasy of the assassin. In the square coffin manacled to my wrist, small countries pleaded through the mesh of graphs in treble-spaced Xeroxed forms to the World Bank, on which I had scrawled the one word, mercy. I sat on a cold bench under some skeletal lindens, two other gentlemen, black skins gone gray, as their identical belted overcoats crossed the white river. They spoke the stilted French of their dark river, whose hooked worm, multiplying its pale sickle, could thin the harvest of the winter streets. "Then we can depend on you to get us these tractors," I gave my word. "May my country ask why you are doing this, sir?" Silence. "You know if you betray us, you cannot hide." A tug, smoke trailing its dark cry. At the window in Haiti, I remember a gecko pressed against the hotel glass, with white palms, concentrating head, with a child's hands. "Mercy, monsieur, mercy." Famine sighs like a scythe across the field of statistics, and the desert is a moving mouth. In the hold of this earth, 10 million shoreless souls are drifting. Somalia, 765,000. Their skeletons will go under the tidal sand. "We'll meet you in Bristol to conclude this agreement." Steeples like tribal lances through congealing fog. The cries of wounded church bells wrapped in cotton. Gray mist enfolding the conspirator like a sealed envelope next to its heart. No one will look up now to see the jet fade like a weevil through a cloud of flour. One flies first class, one is so fortunate. Like a telescope reversed, the traveler's eye swiftly screws down the individual sorrow to an oval nest of antique numerals, and the iris interlocking with this globe condenses it to zero, then a cloud. Beetle black taxi from Heathrow to my flat. We are roaches, riddling the state cabinets, entering the dark holes of power, carapaced in top coats, scuttling around columns, signaling for taxis with frantic antennae, to other huddles with roaches. We infect with optimism, and when the cabinets crack, we are the first to scuttle, radiating separately back to Geneva, Bonn, Washington, London. Under the dripping plains of Hampstead Heath, I read her letter again, watching the drizzle disfigure its pleading like mascara. Margot, I cannot bear to watch the nations cry. Then the phone. We will pay you in Bristol. Days in fetid bedclothes, swallowing cold tea. The phone stifled by the pillow. The telly a blue storm with soundless snow. I'd light the gas and see a tiger's tongue. I was rehearsing the ecstasies of starvation for what I had to do and have not charity. I found my pity desperately researching the origins of history from reed-built communes by sacred lakes, turning with the first sprocketed water-driven wheels. I smelled imagination among bestial hides by the gleam of fat, seeking in all races a common ingenuity. I envisaged an Africa flooded with such light as alchemized the first fields of emmer wheat and barley, when we savages dyed our pale dead with ochre and bordered our temples with the ceremonial vulva of the conch in the gray epoch of the obsidian ads. I sowed the Sahara with rippling cereals. My charity fertilized these aridities. What was my field? Late 16th century. My field was a dank acre, a Sussex down. I taught the Jacobean anxieties. The white devil, Flaminio's torch, startles the brooding ewes. The drawn end comes in strides. I loved my duchess, the white flame of her soul blown out between the smoking cypresses. Then I saw children pounce on green meat with a rat's ferocity. I called them up and took the train to Bristol. My blood, the Severn's, dregs on silver. On Severn's estuary, the pieces flash. Iscariot's salary, patron saint of spies. I thought, who cares how many million starve? Their rising souls will lighten the world's weight and level its gull glittering waterline. We left at sunset down the estuary. England recedes. The forked white gulls screeches circling back. Even the birds are pulled back by their orbit. Even mercy has its magnetic field. Back in the cabin, I uncap the whiskey. The porthole mists with glaucoma. By the time I'm pissed, England will be that pale, serrated indigo on the sea lion. You are so fortunate. You get to see the world. Indeed, indeed, says, I have seen the world. Spray splashes the portholes and vision blurs. Leaning on the hot rail, watching the hot sea, I saw them far off, kneeling on hot sand, in the pious genuflections of the locust, as Ponce's armored kneels crush Florida to the funereal fragrance of white lilies. Now I have come to where the phantoms live. I have no fear of phantoms, but of the real. The Sabbath benedictions of the islands, treble clef of the snail and the scored leaf, the tantum ergo of black choristers soars through the organ pipes of coconuts across the dirty beach surpliced with lace. They pass a brown lagoon behind the priest, pale and unshaven in his frayed soutane, into the concrete church at Canaries. As Albert Schweitzer moves to the harmonium of mourning and to the pluming chimneys, the groundswell lifts, Lebensraum, Lebensraum. Black faces sprinkled with continual dew, dew on the speckled croton, dew on the hard leaf of the knotted plum tree, dew on the elephant ears of the dachshund. Through Kurtz's teeth, white skull in elephant grass, the imperial fiction sings. Sunday wrinkles downriver from the heart of darkness. The heart of darkness is not Africa. The heart of darkness is the core of fire in the white center of the Holocaust. The heart of darkness is a rubber claw selecting a scalpel in antiseptic light. the hills of children's shoes outside the chimneys, the tinkling nickel instruments on the white altar. Jacob, in his last card, sent me these verses. Think of a God who doesn't lose his sleep if trees burst into tears or glaciers weep. So, aping his indifference, I write now, not Anno Domini, after Dachau. The night maid brings a lamp and draws the blinds. I stay out on the veranda with the stars, breakfast congealed to supper on its plate. There is no sea as restless as my mind. The promontories snore, they snore like whales. Cetus, the whale, was Christ. The ember dies, the sky smokes like an ash heap. Reeds wash their hands of guilt, and the lagoon is stained. Louder, since it rained, the gauze of sandflies hisses from the marsh. Since God is dead, and these are not his stars, but manlit, sulphurous sanctuary lamps, it's in the heart of darkness of this earth that backward tribes keep vigil of his body, in Dea, Lampion, and this bedside lamp, keep the news from their blissful ignorance. Like lice, the hungry of this earth swarm to the tree of life. If those who starve like these rain flies, who shed glazed wings in light, grew from sharp shoulder blades their brittle vans and soared towards that tree, how it would seethe our justice. But fires drench them like vermin, quotas prevent them, and they remain compassionate fodder for the travel book, its paragraphs like windows from a train. For everywhere that earth shows its rib cage and the moon goggles with the eyes of children, we turn away to read. Rambo learned that. Rambo at dusk, idling his wrist in water past temples, the plumed days still protect in Roman fire, knew that we cared less for one human face than for the scrolls of Alexandria's ashes, that the bright water could not dye his hand any more than poetry. The dull silhouette moved through the blinding coinage of the river that endlessly, until we pay one debt, shrouds every night an ordinary secret. The drawn sword comes in strides. It stretches for the length of the empty beach. The fishermen's huts shut their eyes tight. A fuisson shakes the palm trees and sweats on the traveler's tree. They found out my sanctuary. Philippe, last night. It had two gentlemen in the village yesterday, sir, asking for you while you was in town. I tell them you was in town. They sent to tell you there is no hurry. They will be coming back. In loaves of cloud and have not charity, the weevil will make a Sahara of Kansas. The ant shall eat Russia. Their soft teeth shall make and have not charity their harvest's desolation. And the brown globe cracked like a begging bowl. And though you fire oceans of surplus grain and have not charity, still through thin stalks the smoking stubble stalks grasshopper, third horseman, the leather-helmed locust. And as a coda, the season of phantasmal peace. Then all the nations of birds lifted together the huge net of the shadows of this earth, in multitudinous dialects, twittering tongues, stitching and crossing it. They lifted up the shadows of long pines down trackless slopes, the shadows of glass-faced towers down evening streets, the shadow of a frail plant on a city sill, the net rising soundless as night, the birds' cries soundless, until there was no longer dusk or season, decline or weather, only this passage of phantasmal light that not the narrowest shadow dared to sever. And men could not see, looking up, what the wild geese drew, what the ospreys trailed behind them in silvery ropes that flashed in the icy sunlight. They could not hear battalions of starlings waging peaceful cries, bearing the net higher, covering this world like the vines of an orchard, or a mother drawing the trembling gauze over the trembling eyes of a child fluttering to sleep. It was a light that you will see at evening on the side of a hill in yellow October, and no one hearing knew what change had brought into the ravens cawing the killdeer's screech, the ember circling chuff, such an immense, soundless, and high concern for the fields and cities where the birds belong. Except it was their seasonal passing, love made seasonless, or from the high privilege of their birth, something brighter than pity for the wingless ones below them who shared dark holes in windows and in houses. And higher they lifted the net with soundless voices, above all change, betrayals of falling suns. And this season lasted one moment, like the pause between dusk and darkness, between fury and peace. But for such as our earth is now, it lasted long. Thank you.
Thank you, Derek. Hard to know what to say now. I'll start off by asking you a few questions. A Spanish journalist, a journal in Spain, Barcelona, has faxed me some questions. They'd be very kind if you could just give them an answer. But the questions are long and complicated, so I'll put it in my own language. In Omaros, there is that heart-stopping, almost heartbreakingly beautiful description of the women with coal baskets in their head going up the gangplank to service the tourist ships or whatever. And you said that looking at their feet, that's how you learned meter, poetic meter. So there is this kind of very intimate connection, isn't there, in your poetry between the people, poverty, if you can use that term, the language they use, and your own writing. You once said you wouldn't have been half the poet you were it not for the fact of the Saint Lucian language, the language that people speak.
What's the question?
Well, that's they want to know. Can you please refer to this language and its specific potential of poetic expression?
It's what
they want to talk. They wanted you to talk about the Creole and the lyricism of the Saint Lucian language.
Well, the quotation is really allegedly from my father, because this is an apparition that I have in the book of talking to my father, who I never knew because he died when I was 1 year old. But he wrote verse. So in the section that they're talking about, he says to the narrator, who I guess must be me, if you want to learn meter, look at the way these people move regularly up and down the gangplank. And these women from my boyhood, I remember as having great bearing and strength, because their baskets weighed 100 weight, and they had to go up a steep, almost a 45 degrees, maybe too sharp, ramp to carry these baskets and go up and down for I don't know how much money. Very, very little. But that's what they did. That's how they earned the keep. So the injunction from my father is to, if you want to relate to what you, I guess what it's saying is, if you want to have a genuine meter, then those feet, pun, the feet of Scansion and the feet, human feet, of these women carrying up the coal, should be an example, if not necessarily of Scansion, but certainly of dedication and example, and that's what's meant. Well, the Creole language is spoken by not too many people in the world. A lot of the Caribbean people in Martinique, Haiti, some Trinidad and Guadeloupe and so forth talk it. I don't write directly in it, because I can't pretend that I think in Creole. I do not. I think in English. And therefore, when imagery comes, it comes from, an English language. But I have tried to translate or compose in Creole. And what is true is that if you're working in a particular language, then it can create its own metaphor. I remember working along with Joseph Brodsky in translation, and he would say, look, if it's and this is to us generally who helped him, what's important is not, it's the meter is primarily important. The metaphor is necessarily and not necessarily important because the language you're in will make its own metaphors. In other words, you might get an English metaphor in a poem written in Russian, and that metaphor in English might be preferable in English than, say, a Russian trying to be exact about the Russian metaphor. I remember that. And I remember in terms of translating, adapting, or writing in French Creole, I remember a section of a poem I was working on in which something I thought it was pretty good in English, and then something even more startling happened when I tried to write it in French Creole. So I think it's not that you're bilingual. I think it's a matter of tone. I think you can get a tone from translation that must approximate the original. I think there's a tone to Dante that can be caught in English, the tone of it, not the exact rendition of the vocabulary.
The second question they were interested in was in relation to your work and Latin American writing. What is the connection between... Do you have a connection with Latin American literature and culture?
Yeah, because it's the same history in a way. It's the same history of plantation society, slavery, sometimes patterns of revolt. In a way, we have another Nobel laureate from the Caribbean, and that's Marquez. It's true. Marquez thinks of himself as a writer of the Caribbean coast. That's where his towns are set. Macondo is on the Caribbean coast of Colombia. So, and he's a great writer in any language. There must be identification in terms of the historical evolution of Latin American Spanish and Latin American literature. Historical resemblance is strong.
Was that enough for you? This is the editor of the Spanish Journal. All right, we'll open the floor up to questions. Would anybody like to ask some questions? Yes. Oh, wait for the microphone. There's a microphone, yeah? And is there a second question as well so that we can get the microphone lined up? Yeah, okay.
You said earlier that you looked at other poets that you admire for how they've dedicated their life to poetry. I was wondering if you could just explain what that means to you, perhaps as an example or a challenge or a warning to the other writers here.
What? A warning to the other writers here. Like Brodsky, you once said, almost died because of his poetry, or died because of his poetry.
A warning?
Yeah, because these are young poets, a few young poets here.
I don't quite get the warning thing. What do you mean by... But what I meant about Joseph was, what I learned from him was a little more dedication because, any writer writes. And then after a while you get into a rhythm where you say, well, I write, I'm a writer. And then you come across someone, especially a poet, whose whole, day was consumed in terms of poetry. Now, I don't mean that he was like fanatic in terms of how he wrote, but I think I was floating a little too much. And what I had to remember and respect was that a great deal of poetry has to do with intelligence, and I wasn't working. I don't think I was, to depend on your imagination or fits of vision or that sort of thing is not really... What Joseph was really an example of was someone whose industry was a consequence or a cause of his writing. And I think that the things that, I don't like to give any advice to anybody, but, or even worse, to young writers, because that puts you in a position where you have succeeded in doing something which you haven't. But I would say that you also have a mind. You don't just have inspiration, and that the practice of intelligence wasn't a common thing and still is perhaps not a common thing. Joseph was a great admirer of the metaphysical poets, in which, you know, like Eliot pointed out, that a thought was as immediate as the smell of a rose. So that the metaphor is about thought, not about parallels. In other words, kind of a difference between being just Keatsian and being like Donne. Anyway, that's a very easy, cheap translation, but I think that's it. But what I learned is more discipline, more application towards the poem in making it have intelligence, not just a kind of easy joy or easy sorrow. Is that okay?
Yeah. Hello. In your poem, A Far Cry from Africa, you say, "I'm poisoned with the blood of both." I just wondered if you could explain what it's like for a man of mixed race growing up in the Caribbean.
Can you repeat that, please? You should speak a bit louder.
In your poem, A Far Cry from Africa, you say that I am poisoned with the blood of both. I just wondered if you could explain what it was like for a man of mixed race growing up in the Caribbean.
Yeah, in your poem, Far Cry to Africa, you talked about your blood being poisoned by the blood of both. So he wants to find out what it is being a mixed, what did you say, mixed race person growing up in St. Lucia? Caribbean, yeah.
Well, it's not just that. It's not that there's no separation, no division of identity and an experience that is human, you know, that whatever the British did to the Kenyans, you know, and the Kenyans did to the British, that's human, that's lupus hominy, you know. Man is wolf to man, black or white. That's the basis of what the poem, and the horror of that truth, no matter what side you're on. And I have gotten, you know, a lot of flack from black people for writing that, you know. Because if you stay only on the level of the political reason for anything, then you leave out. You see, you can justify anything. You can justify the Holocaust. You can say the Germans had a very good argument because they felt X was happening to their country and they thought the Jews were responsible or whatever. And the logic of what people do in terms of a tyranny or a dictatorship is very logical. It's based on reason. And the enemy and destroyer of things is what Goya calls the dream of reason produces monsters. You know, the horror that produces is all based on argument, on logic. Fanatical dictatorship, right? Including a ban on smoking. We were just talking about that. You know, can get fanatical, and you can say, well, smoking is very bad for you. But I don't think a country should get to the point where it can't let people smoke in the streets. I mean, you can take a thing to an absurdity and have very good reasons for doing whatever you do. And the situation in A Far Cry from Africa was as horrific as it was to have to write that, then you were saying to yourself, look, I am a human being and both monsters are in me, right?
Yes, I should remind people that you once said famously that you never, talking about the horror of reason, you never put Descartes before the horse. And talking about race, I said to Derek by telephone, your grandfather is from Warwickshire, your father's first name was Warwick. Whilst you're here, I'll take you to visit the village. Do you know which village it was? He said, no, but we could fake it. Right, and other questions? Two, yeah. Salvador. Oh, you can't hear clearly. Sorry about that, yeah. So, Salvador first in the front in red, and then somebody else? Who else?
Yeah, it's all right. My question is about, I'm a translator, and
I was talking to David about translating your poetry into Spanish, if you allowed me and if it had not been done. And after reading your poetry, I don't think I want to translate it. It's too difficult. It's the craft is incredible. The way you write, you know, reminds me of Canto General of Neruda. I'm thinking of a poem, Tropic Zone. And your knowledge of Spanish culture is immense. And I want to ask you two questions. The first one, when and how did you know you were a poet? Did poetry was looking for you, or were you looking for poetry? And will you discover that moment in which you discovered you were a poet, that you are a poet? You know, I'm sure about that. How do you prepare yourself to be such a great poet? How do you, for just beginners in poetry, how do you research? How do you try to look for things? How to look into nature, into culture, into language, into race, into suffering, into identification with nature? All these beautiful things that I can read, all these beautiful metaphors, like the lancers of Spain raping Cuba, all these things that really are so beautiful and so in place in that great poem. Thank you.
So the question is, the first one is, were you looking for poetry, or did poetry find you?
I think I'm very lucky in this respect. My father died, as I said, when my brother and I were 1 year old, and my mother brought us up with a lot of sacrifice, an example. But I knew that my father wrote and painted very well. So I knew from childhood that that's what I wanted to do. And I think, I don't want to make it too melodramatic, but I think I just wanted to continue my father's work, and I knew that from childhood. So I knew where I was, I knew what I wanted to do that early. And my mother understood that, which is a benediction, a blessing, that she didn't say, well, you know, you should be a lawyer, you know, or be a doctor, there's more money in it, you know, which is true. But that's what I consider to be a great deal of luck and blessing. Also, my mother used to recite around the house. She was a great corny actress. She was good. She could recite well. And I always felt that one day I'd like to hear my mother recite something I wrote, you know, because she would quote, you know, different speeches from, you know, Henry, you know, Cardinal Wolsey's Farewell and all that, and she'd just do it, and we'd ask her to shut up sometimes because she went on and on, you know. But she was a great woman, and she knew that. So I knew that I wanted to be a writer. I also say something. You see, when you're in my position now, facing an audience, and when you're asked questions, you can decide, well, I'll sort of feint the answers. I'll just slide them off, slough them off, because you really can't get that personal in front of all these people. And so I'm going to say something that you shouldn't say. It's so private. But I really think that if you are a poet, and I think it's a gift. I think that someone who can paint well, some prodigious painter, that it is a gift. And if you ask where the gift comes from, then I have to get even more corny and say, maybe it's divine, maybe it's a benediction, maybe it's a blessing. But I think that all art is a manifestation of that belief that a gift is a benediction. It doesn't matter who the painter is. Even if it's Goyan, it appears to be something, black and dirty. Or not dirty, but black and pessimistic.
Can somebody please tell me what time it is? What time? 10:15. So I think we've got time for two more questions. Two more questions. Can you put your hands up, please? First, yes. The gentleman. Yeah.
Are you working on a new volume of poems now?
Are you working on a new volume of poetry, Prodigal?
Yes, I have a new book
book-length poem during, I think, in October from Faber here and from Farrar Straus in New York.
Entitled?
The Prodigal.
The Prodigal.
I hate the title. Don't buy it.
And have you illustrated it yourself? Does it carry your paintings?
I don't know the cover yet. So it probably is going to be as a painting of mine that I think I'd like to use.
And John, the last question. Yes.
Derek, isn't the Caribbean just a myth? Isn't it just a dream now? Is it just the 52nd state of the U.S.?
Is the Caribbean just an appendage of the United States and no longer has an existence in its own, of its own? Yeah.
A very, very serious question. But isn't everywhere? What?
Not as much.
Here? I thought Bush and Blair were buddy-buddy. No, I think that the size and scale and influence of the American Empire, the global influence culturally, has never been a precedent to it. I'm talking about the world. I'm talking about whatever kind of music is played in Taiwan, or what clothes are bought in Taiwan, and who wants to be American. I think that is larger than anything that ever happened in the history of the world. And we are just below America, and I think that the cultural influence of that empire is the biggest that's ever happened in the history of the world.
Is it positive?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, because the great thing about America is that you can genuinely say what you like without being, you know, without any intimidation of arrest or censorship, which is a great thing that some countries don't understand or even think they can start to appreciate. That's one of the great things of that country, of that empire, if you want. The other thing is the individual American has no idea of dominating the rest of the world. You couldn't say that about any of the empires in Europe, French, German, Spanish, whatever. So anybody who was a citizen of France felt that they owned Algeria, you know, or whatever. So that the ownership came from the citizenship. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had an empire. But there's not, while there's now an influential empire in America in terms of the culture, it is not the idea of the average American to want to dominate the world as opposed or take pride in any conquest of any part of the world. I live there, and I don't think that. That could not be true then in the 19th century of people taking pride. I remember talking to a Swiss guy in Stockholm, an actor. He was very funny. And talking about the same kind of thing about influence. And I said, well, what about Sweden? He said, yeah, we had an empire. I said, there you are, right?
Right. Well, I have to bring this to a close now. Derek Walcott will be signing books afterwards. And then we're all going off for a curry. You're more than welcome to join us. It's called the Bombay Palace in Earlston High Street. I have no shares in it, so I'm not plugging it. But anybody could come along in Earlston High Street and have a curry. If you want your photograph taken with Walcott, we'll charge you. I would like to call upon Professor Gad Heumann, just to say a few words about the Center for Caribbean Studies, since this is the 20th anniversary of the Center for Caribbean Studies at the University of Warwick, and Gad is the current director. So maybe you can just say just a couple of words about the 20th anniversary and the program that we have for this year.
It's a great thing to be asked to speak after Derek Walcott, particularly with approximately 10 seconds notice. So I will just say...
You're an American, you can
I'm
do
an
it.
American, I can get away with it. So I will just say that this is the first event, really, in the 20th anniversary celebrations of the Center for Caribbean Studies. And we have a whole series of events lined up. And it's part of a commemoration in a way. And of course, Derek Walcott was here 7 years ago. We gave him an honorary degree, and he performed previously in this particular place. And so we remember a lot of very interesting activities that we've been involved with. We have a fundraising campaign, which this event, in theory, is part of, but really it's about language, literature, and history. And we're very glad you could come and join us, and we look forward to your participation in other events.
Thank you. Thanks, Kat. Let me just formally, very briefly, thank Derek Walcott for making the trip from St. Lucia to the University of Warwick. The university prize, as you know, is called the Derek Walcott Prize. I said to him, in Kent University, they have the T.S. Eliot Prize. He said, who Eliot? you know, I've said this last week when I was introducing you, so I do forgive me for repeating myself, but one of the words that crops up in your writing is the word benediction. I think you mentioned it twice today, and I would just like to thank you on behalf of all of us for the benediction of your poetry. Thank you.